lot for everyone for coming, and I'm really glad to be here, and I'm really glad to talk to you. Thanks everyone who helped with the organizational issues of this visit. So as you can see from the title, I will be talking today about the capacity of authoritarian regimes to withstand the challenges to their rule. And the empirical case that I will investigate is the case of Putin's regime in Russia that was successfully able to withstand its rule, to withstand the challenge to its rule in the beginning of this decade. Yeah, by the way, if you don't have a handout for this talk, two handouts, a blue and a pink one, please grab one. So the challenge to Putin's regime in the beginning of this decade was related to significantly declined support of the regime among the population. You may know that Putin's support was steadily growing from the year 2000, when he was first elected as president, to 2008, during his first two presidential terms. And usually experts agree that that support, the growth of support, was related to economic performance of the country. People simply started to live better, and that's why the support increased. This chart shows us the decline of Putin's support from March 2008, when Medvedev was elected as president, to March 2012, when Putin was re-elected as president. And the approval index is the difference between those who approve Putin's actions and those who disapprove Putin's actions, right? So this 78 figure number means that 78% more people approve Putin's actions than disapprove. So this is actually a very huge number, right? So as you can see, the approval of Putin's actions was declining, particularly rapidly after 2010. So by the start of, somewhere here, by the start of the third electoral campaign of Putin for his third re-election, he had the lowest approval rating in history, and also 100,000 people protesting on the streets of Moscow against the results of the parliamentary election, right? Nevertheless, 3 months later, he won the elections with 64% of vote, which was only 6 to 7% less than he received in 2004 or Dmitry Medvedev received in 2008 when the regime was popular, right? So we see that if in 2008 there was no really gap between the real popularity of the regime and electoral support, in 2012 we do see this gap. And my paper is related to figuring out where this gap is coming from. So the argument that I'm going to advance is that unlike in 2004 and 2008, when people sincerely supported the regime because of the good state of the economy, the 2012 electoral victory was obtained due to the administrative leverage over school teachers, who were the members of local electoral commissions and who helped to falsify the electoral results. Most polling stations in Russia and in many other countries are situated in schools, and teachers comprise a big share of the members of local electoral commissions. So basically, the municipal authorities coupled together with city-level electoral commissions to put pressure on teachers, to threaten them, most frequently with the job loss or benefits loss, to force them to falsify elections. So before I start kind of substantiating this claim, let me step back a little bit and talk for a minute about why someone who doesn't care about Putin and maybe doesn't care about Russia could still be interested in this particular case. So scholars have been trying to think and explain authoritarian resilience for a number of years now. And they have mentioned many different factors. And one of the most frequently mentioned factors is the social policy of the autocrat. So basically, autocrats give people free stuff to buy their loyalty. And we can think about the examples of clientelistic practices somewhere in Latin America, where political support is directly exchanged for material goods. We can think about authoritarian social pacts, where large state governmental employment coupled with a pretty universal social safety network is exchanged for political support and quiescence, which was the case in the Soviet Union, which is now the case in many Middle Eastern oil-rich countries. And in contemporary Russia, that's also one of the factors that mentioned frequently, because people say, well, public sector employees, budgetniki, they simply support the regime in disproportionate numbers because their income is dependent on the state budget, which makes sense, right? Another factor that is also frequently mentioned by scholars is the infrastructural or organizational state power. Basically, the stronger the organizations on which autocrat builds a rule, the more resilient the regime. If an autocrat has efficient bureaucracies, very developed police and the army, and the ruling party that also helps to sustain the rule. So all these three components, they help to implement decisions on the ground level, they help to exercise repression, they help to exercise surveillance, right? So what I'm trying to argue by telling you the story about school teachers is that the public sector actually works as an extension of the state bureaucracy. And it is related to authoritarian resilience, not only through redistribution, but also through the infrastructural state power. Because if you think about public sector, it's not simply an ATM machine that gives people the money, right? It involves a lot of organizational hierarchies and networks. And these organizational hierarchies and networks, they possess certain qualities that make them particularly useful for an autocrat. Think about an ordinary person. The frequency of communication with teachers, doctors, social workers, and all kinds of such people is probably much greater than the frequency of communication with the police, with party activists, and even with the state bureaucrats. So the public sector organizations, they are embedded into the society. They penetrate the society to the ground level. And they are ubiquitous. They are present everywhere. Even in a small village, you probably find some kind of a medical facility and some kind of a school. Second feature is that the public sector employees, they are the trusted members of the community. And they may not be completely trusted, but they're definitely trusted much more than police officers. You probably trust more to the person who is teaching your child than to state bureaucrat. So they are embedded and they are trusted, but at the same time, they are directly connected to the state apparatus, which makes it easy to send orders down the line to monitor how those orders are executed. So these two mechanisms, redistribution and infrastructural state power, usually they are pretty difficult to separate in vehicle. Because what autocrats do, they just use all the means that are at their disposal to strengthen their rule, right? I think that 2012 presidential elections in Russia actually give us an opportunity to separate those two. Exactly because we know that economic performance stopped legitimizing the regime. So probably this redistribution mechanism kind of went on the background, even if it existed. And that's where we can see if there is something else behind it. So my case of school teachers being involved in intellectual falsification is actually an example of how the public sector organizations can work as an extension of the state apparatus, and in this way contribute to authoritarian resilience through the infrastructural state power, rather than through this redistribution. Okay, so I have two types of evidence to present. I have qualitative evidence and quantitative evidence. From the qualitative evidence, we will learn how actually the falsification process worked. Who went to whom, who put pressure on whom, and how all this interaction unraveled. And that data will come mostly from the testimonies of observers and whistleblowers, and also the reaction of the teachers' community, which I took mostly from the media. These sources, they will give us a great idea about how the falsification process worked, but they can't answer some other questions. For example, whether the involvement of school teachers in falsification was actually systematic, or were those cases reported just isolated cases? We also don't know, even if it was systematic, how large was the effect? Did it actually change the electoral percentage of Putin significantly or not? And finally, we also don't know from those sources whether this effect of infrastructural state power, how it potentially connects to the effect of redistribution. So maybe it's just teachers voting in large numbers for the regime rather than falsifying elections. So to answer those questions, I will analyze a regional level data set that includes electoral data, budget data, and different kinds of statistical data. Okay, so let's first look at the qualitative evidence. So this idea that teachers are involved in falsification spirit, it's not particularly new in Russia, not like no one knows about it, right? So people have been talking about it. And the fact that teachers are disproportionately members of electoral commissions, that's a common knowledge. And I frequently get a question, so how many exactly teachers are there? And unfortunately, I can't answer that question because the exact data are unavailable. Precinct level electoral commissions, they're not obligated to publish the place of work of their members. That's why we don't know for sure how many exactly teachers are on electoral commissions. However, what we know for sure, we know that the vast majority of polling stations are situated in schools. Also, we have some rough estimates from the people who are inside the system. And one of the reasonable estimates that I was able to find comes from the head of the Moscow Electoral Commission, who said that roughly 50% of precinct level commission members are teachers. So it's a pretty huge number. So the information about involvement of those teachers into falsifications comes a lot from independent observers and journalists. But the most striking evidence comes also from the testimonies of the teachers themselves, some of whom became whistleblowers. So this woman is Tatiana Ivanova, very Russian last name, very classic. She was a teacher in St. Petersburg, and she was also the head of the local electoral commission. So she was forced to falsify elections, parliamentary elections, in December 2011, and she refused to do that. She was she had to leave her work, her job as a teacher a few weeks after that, and then she met with journalists and told them the whole story. So she said, "I have been the head of the electoral commission in our school for 14 years, but I have never encountered such a pressure. This time, most of commission heads were new, almost all of them school principals. They gathered us in the social services center and worked over five people at a time behind closed doors. First, they said, I should have kept the observers far away from the ballot box. If they disagreed, I should have threatened to call the police. Second, commission heads were told to stuff the ballot box with 200 ballots for the regional parliament and another 200 for Duma. Third, we had to falsify the signatures of those voters who did not show up so that all numbers matched. She also said that after the polling stations closed and votes were counted and protocols signed, the city-level electoral commission spent the whole night trying to correct the numbers in those protocols. And cases like this have been reported, maybe not directly by the heads of the electoral commissions, but by observers and other people in many Russian cities. Such a pressure on teachers triggered the resistance from the teachers' community itself. And this is one of the examples of this resistance. On February 2nd, 2012, roughly a month before the presidential election in 2012, Novaya Gazeta published this letter signed by 150 teachers. And the letter said, "We appeal to the teachers' community all over Russia to exercise the utmost responsibility and integrity, to prevent law violations and fraud, to prevent any activities that may put into question the legitimacy of election results. Teachers are able to do a lot to make elections fair. Voting frequently takes place in schools, and teachers and school principals often serve as members of electoral commissions. The future of Russia, to a large extent, depends on whether our concerted effort is able to protect the people's will from falsification in the upcoming presidential election." Another example of resistance. This is Tamara Edelman. She's a distinguished teacher of Russia from Moscow. And on September 2nd, 2013, few days before the regional elections in many Russian regions took place. She addressed her colleagues in a YouTube video that was published by a Russian opposition politician, Alexei Navalny. She said, "If you falsify the protocols at the polling stations or let others do it, how will you look into the children's eyes? How will you enter the classroom after that? How will you look into the children's eyes? We all know children have a great intuition. They always feel the lies. These lies will eat you away and will not allow you to continue being a teacher, regardless of what subject you teach. I urge all teachers who will work in electoral commissions to simply obey the law." And not only teachers themselves resisted this pressure, also some other parties tried to help the teachers to resist that pressure. For example, Novaya Gazeta declared March 4th, 2012, that the day of those elections that I'm investigating, it declared it a teacher's day. And she said that we're gonna help all the teachers who decide to report procedural violations. We're gonna make it public and support you. Also, some regional deputies in St. Petersburg, they publicly offered legal help to whistleblowers. Some civil society activists tried to use other tactics, like public shaming. So they created lists of teachers in Moscow and St. Petersburg that were reported to participate in elections, in falsifications, because they said that we want to prevent those teachers to teach our children. So we used to have only this kind of evidence, kind of qualitative evidence about the involvement of teachers in intellectual fraud. We knew that there existed a number of confirmed cases of pressure, and we also knew that the professional community was very concerned, which probably gave us a clue that the pressure wasn't, like, those cases weren't isolated. However, as I said, we didn't know whether the pressure was really systematic across the country, how large was the impact of those falsifications, and how it potentially connects to some other mechanisms. So now I'm going to present a quantitative analysis that will help us answer those questions. So you may remember this very first slide where I showed you the gap between the real support of Putin's regime and the electoral percentage rate. And we also know that from just other research and theory that authoritarian regimes want not only to win elections, but to decisively win elections. They want to win them by a large margin to demonstrate that they are actually powerful. So I will treat the ability to get to that wide margin in the situation when real support declined as regime resilience. So I calculated the difference between the percentage that Putin received in 2012 and the percentage that Medvedev received in 2008. So that positive numbers will mean increase of support, and negative numbers will mean decrease of support. Nationwide, as you can see, support decreased by about 7%. But behind those 7%, there is a huge regional variation from minus 25 in Moscow to plus 11 in Chechnya. So, yeah, not surprising. So I will use the regional variation in the change of percentage in regime resilience, in the change of percentage as a measure of regime resilience. So we are in those regions where the regional authorities were able to maintain high electoral percentage, the regime resilience is high. In those regions where the electoral percentage went down together with real support, the regime resilience is low. So in the competing hypothesis to explain this outcome, they correspond to those two mechanisms that I showed, the redistribution and infrastructural state power. So the well-being hypothesis tells us that the regime's electoral support depends on the economic well-being of the population. Pretty simple. People live well, they support the regime. Life gets worse, people don't support the regime. So according to this hypothesis, the difference between Medvedev's percentage and Putin's percentage should depend on the difference between the well-being in 2008 and well-being in 2012. So basically, regime resilience will depend on this difference in well-being between the two points in time. The infrastructural hypothesis tells us that regime resilience, not support, resilience, depends on the infrastructural state power, and in this case, the leverage over school teachers. just know that the infrastructural state power is only measured in 2012, because that's the moment when the regime started to need it. It didn't need to use the infrastructural state power in 2008 because the regime support was high. So at the very abstract level, my model looks approximately like this. Regime resilience depends on the difference between the well-being in two points of time and on the infrastructural state power in 2012. So let's now quickly go through the operationalization of these two hypotheses, two sets of variables. So I separate well-being into two components, general economic performance and redistribution for social policy. So following the economic voting literature, I use the personal income inflation rate and unemployment rate as the indicators of general economic performance. To measure redistribution, I take regional budget expenditures on education, healthcare, and social security, and also the number of beneficiaries, the number of budgetniki, the public sector employees per 10,000 population. Teachers, doctors, government employees, and also pensioners, because the data was readily available, and it's also very common to hear that pensioners support the regime more. So, among the infrastructural variables, the most important ones are the variables that I call organizational density. It's the number of public sector employees per 10,000 population. And you can see that it's actually the same variable as here. The difference is that here I take the change between the end of 2007 and the end of 2011. So if budgetniki, public sector employees, actually support the regime more, then the change in support should depend in the change of the share of these groups. So here, I use the number of public sector employees only at the end of 2011. Why I think it kind of captures the infrastructural state power. Imagine a region with a high number of teachers per unit population. That probably means that the share of teacher jobs on the local job market is pretty high. And that also means that alternative employment is not very readily available, right? So, also, it means that it's simply way easier to find a person who is particularly vulnerable, let's say a single mother of two children who doesn't have any other job prospects, to put pressure on and force to falsify elections. So basically, which would be very different in the regions where there is small number of teachers per unit of population, because that means probably there are lots of other potential jobs available, and it's not as critical for an average teacher to lose the job. So two other factors I think are related to the organizational variables. Unemployment rate. If unemployment is high, of course, the threat of job loss is more serious. Also, if the regional budget became much more dependent on the federal budget during those 4 years, that means that the governors have a lot more stimulus to put pressure on their state apparatus and the public sector employees to deliver the numbers so that, you know, they feed the regional budget certain level. And also I use two controls, the share of urban population, which is important because I'm concentrating on teachers and the number of teachers in rural areas is definitely much higher than in urban areas, just because in rural areas we have smaller schools. And also the non-Russian region, which is very frequent control for all kinds of electoral studies. So a little bit more boring stuff. When I plug my variables into the model, that's what I get. Regime resilience, the difference between Medvedev's and electoral support and Putin's electoral support depends on a set of variables related to economic well-being of the population and a set of variables related to infrastructural state power. To make this model a little bit more flexible, I move the Medvedev's electoral percentage from the left part of the equation to the right part of the equation so that this B0 coefficient can vary from 1. Although it's essentially the same equation. And this is going to be my final model. So before I talk about the results, let me just note that this model is not a sample model, it's a population model. That means that the concept of statistical significance is irrelevant here, because I have almost all Russian regions in my data set, and they cannot be treated as a random sample of anything, right? They are a population. So instead of talking about statistical significance, I will talk about random systematic effects and their relationship to random effects. And I will use t values, which is essentially the ratio between regression coefficient and the standard error, in which case, and in this case, regression coefficient will represent the systematic effect of the predictor, and the standard error will represent the random effect of the predictor. So if the t value is less than 1, it means that the random effect is larger and there is pretty much no systematic effect. If it's equal to 1, it means that they're similar, and if it's more than 1, it means that the systematic effect is larger. So basically, we want the t value to be as far away from 1 as possible, as large as possible. So what I will do, I will compare the t values of the predictors corresponding to the well-being hypothesis and to the infrastructural hypothesis. And I will see which one has the most systematic effect on the outcome. Okay, so this table is just some lines of the full model, which you can see on the handout. So let me first explain the structure of models, and then we will answer all these three questions that I posed for the quantitative analysis. So the well-being model, it includes only well-being predictors. The infrastructural model 1 includes all the predictors, both well-being and infrastructural, except for pensioners, because they were highly correlated with unemployment, which makes sense. The higher the unemployment, the faster the people retire, so I have to drop out. And because this model, the infrastructural model 1, has 14 predictors, and I only have 79 cases, to kind of alleviate this potential problem with overdetermination, I include in infrastructural model 2 only the predictors with most systematic effect, or those that are important to me theoretically. So the first question that I posed for the quantitative analysis was, okay, we have all these testimonies from school or from school teachers that they have been pressured. Is this pressure actually systematic throughout the country? So, and to see if there was a systematic effect in all regions, we have to look at the t values of teacher density. And we see that those t-values are 2.61 in one model and 3.59 in one model, which is, it's pretty big. So it's far away from 1, particularly if you compare with the t-values for doctors and executive government employees. You see that those do not even come close to the result of teachers, right? So teachers do have a systematic, teacher density does have a systematic effect on vision resilience. And it's the teachers, but not doctors or government employees, who have this effect. So if it was true that the public sector employees, budgetniki in Russia, support the regime more disproportionately, that should have been true both for doctors and government employees, because in this sense, they're no different from teachers. They also depend on the state budget in terms of their income. But we clearly see that teachers do have a clear systematic effect, while other groups of budgetniki they don't. So the second question was we do have a systematic effect. How large is this effect? Has it changed a lot with this percentage? So now don't look on the size of the regression coefficients, because regression coefficients depend on the units of the measurement. So here, look instead on the spatial regression plots and on this slide. What I did on this slide, I compared the magnitude of the effect of Medvedev's percentage, the strongest predictor that absorbs a lot of regional variation. So I compared the effect of Medvedev's electoral support and teacher density. So if we take infrastructural model 2 and we fix all the variables somewhere in the middle, and start varying with very subtle support from 3 standard deviations below the mean to 3 standard deviations above the mean, our outcome variable, Putin's lateral support, will vary from 44% to 84%. So Medvedev's lateral support will explain 40% of the variation of the outcome. If we do the same with teacher density, it's going to explain 14% from 57 to 71, which is actually, to me, it looks like a pretty big number, because Medvedev's lateral support is a very, it's a very trivial predictor, which of course would explain a lot. So the fact that Medvedev's lateral support explains 40%, if teacher density explains 14, means that teacher density has a very, very non-trivial effect on regime resilience. So this 14% don't mean that Putin got 14% only from teachers, because we have to factor in also the size of the region. But still, it shows us that the teacher effect is non-trivial at all. So third question. How the effect of the administrative resource is pressure on teachers compares potentially to the effect of redistribution of social policy? So now let's compare whether the effect of well-being variable to the effect of the infrastructural variable. So if you look at the t values, which are in parentheses in the well-being model, you will see that most of them are less than 1, which means that there is no systematic effect. And those cells that where TVLs are less than 1, they're shaded, right? So there's one exception, which is social security expenditures. And we'll get back to that, because it does have TVL that's larger than 1, kind of larger than 1. The problem is that it has a wrong sign. So we'll get back to that. Let's now look at the infrastructural model. So when we add the infrastructural variables, some of the T values of the well-being indicators, they do get larger, but they're still not comparable to the effect of teacher density at all. So now let's look closer into the two variables that actually seem to have some effect. It's not like completely negligible. But the problem is that they have wrong sign, wrong compared to what we would expect if the well-being hypothesis was true. So these two variables are the regional budget expenditures, the change in regional budget expenditures on social security, and the change in teacher density. So actually, teacher density thing is easier to explain. If you look into the descriptive statistics in this handout, you will see that the mean value of the change in teacher density is negative, which basically means that in most regions, teachers were losing jobs between the years of 2007 and 2011. Most regions were shrinking their teaching force. The negative sign of this coefficient means that the more teachers lost their jobs in the region, the higher the regime resilience, the higher the ability of the regional government to maintain electoral percentage at a high level. Which again makes sense. If teachers were threatened to lose their jobs, and actually more teachers lost their jobs in the previous 4 years, the threat of losing a job becomes more credible. So this sign is impossible to explain within the well-being hypothesis, but it totally makes sense within the infrastructural hypothesis. So the social security expenditures are a little harder to explain, and they are important because they actually do seem to have pretty systematic effect. What I think is going on here, I think it may be capturing exactly the same thing as teachers, but with social workers. And unfortunately, I don't have the data for social workers because they don't exist, they're very decentralized, and it's very difficult to count how many social workers exist in the region. But I believe if I had the data for social workers and I would control for them, probably we would have this effect go away, and we could have this kind of a similar picture as with teachers. Although if you have any other potential explanations, I would be happy to. Yeah, and just one note, the magnitude of the effect. of the change in social security expenditures. For Medvedev's level of support, it was 40%, for Tisha Dempsey, it was 14%. Here, it's 8%, which also seems to me as a non-trivial number, particularly because this is a very noisy variable. It doesn't even capture what I think is going on in real. Okay, just to recap, what do we have at the end? We actually don't have a lot of support for the well-being hypothesis, at least in this particular case of 2012 presidential elections in Russia. But instead, we see a clear and robust effect of teacher density. We don't see a similar effect for other groups of public sector employees, and we also see these negative signs of change in teacher density and the social security expenditures. So basically, and I'm kind of concluding, so this analysis demonstrates us that public sector and social policy, they can be connected to authority and resilience not only through redistribution, but also through the infrastructural state power. And I don't mean to say that redistribution is not important. Of course it is important, and it exists. The thing is that in this particular historical situation, in this particular historical moment, the infrastructural state power happened to be more salient and more visible. So if we only concentrate on redistribution when we're talking about social policies and authoritarianism, we can potentially miss this other important mechanism that connects public sector organizations and authoritarian resilience. And also, we don't have to think only about teachers, because we can think about social workers in kind of the same situation. We can think about youth organizations. We can think about pensioners organizations. And I actually do look into those cases, but in other chapters of my dissertation. I'll be happy to talk about them in the Q&A. But for now, that's it. Thank you.
Okay, questions or comments? Reactions?
Your argument is that the way teachers are important, and I guess public sector employees generally, is the embeddedness, the trust that they might have, and connection to the state. But kind of the story you're telling about teachers, maybe that's not the whole story, is that they didn't so much create support for the regime as falsified the election results. Is this the case, or and is this how kind of is this where the what was the main goal in being workers in polling stations and falsifying the election results? So in this case, trust isn't important, but the leverage that the state has over them is what. Mm-hmm.
So I think the problem is that I do see those statistical relationships, but I cannot say for sure that it was only falsifications, because I can easily imagine there are some also qualitative evidence that teachers were used as agitators also. And if I was an autocrat, why not? Why not to use teachers as both falsifiers and agitators? Whatever works to get the result, to get the official electoral percentage, because it is the official electoral percentage that makes the regime legitimate, right? So, and in this sense, your question, if I correctly understood the question, that the teachers don't actually create a real support among the population. So, yeah, it's great to have real support among the population, but sometimes it doesn't work out. People aren't stupid. People don't live well. They don't support the regime. So, but it's important for contemporary electoral authoritarian regimes to get the high percentage, because it's the percent, then they can say publicly, we're a democracy, people elected us. They can say at the international arena, they can say it in the domestic arena, because they control the media, they can transmit this message. So it's great to have real support, but if you don't have real support, at least you need electoral percentage. So that's what I'm trying to show, that the real support was in place in the 2000s, and it's not in place, it wasn't in place in 2012. So in this sense, they still work for regime resilience in a sense, but I agree that they don't work for sincere, at least not as much for sincere support of regime.
So, can you test that? The Levada Center data is probably comes from 49 regions. You can do a region level analysis.
Well, maybe 49 regions, but like all the regions, as far as I know, only FOM has that, and it's kind of difficult to get, right? So yeah, I agree it would be great to compare not with Medvedev's percentage, but with real support too, and see
right.
if that works.
Right,
and I have been trying to work with Bill Reisinger, and he was trying to make a small area estimate piece for me and try to come up with an evaluation, like an estimate of real support in the regions, real Putin support. And it didn't work out because Putin support didn't have enough variation. Which actually means that because my dependent variable kind of assumes that the support fell to the same degree in all regions, right? And I do it just because I don't have better data, but that fact that Putin support didn't have enough variation to estimate support in each region actually tells us that it's not completely unreasonable. Yeah, but I agree that if I had better data, and if you happen to see them, please let me know.
Could you tell us a little bit more about the qualitative data that you were working with? You focused mostly in your discussion on your analysis of the quantitative data that you had, and so you you showed us one YouTube clip or a transcript from a YouTube clip that was cautioning against a certain behavior, and then one that was a whistleblower who talked to a journalist. Did you have more than that? Were you working
mostly
with
more than that.
Documents or?
Yeah, I do have more than that. I work with newspaper databases, and I pulled out all kinds of like small articles where either journalists talk about it or some, you know, it's frequently in some small regions, actually in the Caucasus, that like for some reason it's a very controversial issue. The observers there would go and see all those things and would start writing to newspapers this open letters, like all these teachers don't tell us that you're like, you feel sorry for them, don't feel sorry for them, they're doing this, terrible things. And so I do have more data. The problem is that they're just as unsystematic as what I showed you. I just showed you something that was particularly visible. And those cases, there were a couple of heads of local electoral commissions, like Tatiana Ivanova, and there was another one, who just stepped up publicly testified about all these falsifications. So yeah, there are some more data.
Were there reprisals against the whistleblower teacher?
Yeah, I was wondering what.
Yes,
Tatiana
Ivanova was sued in the court by someone from the municipal department of education, because it was that woman who was putting pressure on teachers and threatening to fire principals and put some pressure on teachers. So. And Tatiana Ivanova told the journalist the name of that woman. So that woman sued her in court that that was a lie and you are, you know, damaging your reputation and everything. So I think that, you know, I do not remember for sure what was the final result, because there were a lot of appeals, and the court actually first, it said that Tatiana Ivanova has to pay some kind of fine to that woman, and that fine was relatively small, and then Tatiana Ivanova wanted to appeal. So there was a litigation, and it was definitely, it was consequential for her. So first she left her job, but the thing is that, you know, she was from St. Petersburg. St. Petersburg is a pretty rich city, you know? It's not a small village where you have no other income. Second, she was at the retirement age, so she could just retire. And that's what she did. She retired and started to take care of her grandson. So she was in the position to actually do this, while some other teachers who are in other locations and in other situations may not really have the stewardship material, even if they wanted to do that.
Is there a follow-up question about the qualitative data that you looked at? Do you, so you are suggesting that it was negative pressure on teachers, if we buy that there was, the teachers did falsify the election results, that you're implying that it was negative pressure, it was fear of losing your job, it was fear of some kind of reprisal, but did you see anything that might give you a sense that there were some sort of positive, some sort of benefits for teachers who we all know are just sort
well,
of paid and right?
It's usually not the teacher, it was simply my money that they offered some of the heads of local electoral commissions, and it was 2 to 3 months of teacher salary.
And the teacher would receive or know that the head of
the head of a local commission, who is usually either, you know, a teacher or a school principal. So they, well, at least in St. Petersburg, and I think it was actually Tatiana Ivanova who said that they offered them money also. But the thing is that, you know, they offer you money if you cooperate, but if you don't cooperate, you will get all these negative consequences. It's not that you simply don't get the money.
So there's a small positive, you know,
well, relatively small,
benefit,
relatively small, because I bet that in poorer regions, they didn't do that. I just can't imagine that they would spend money on that. It's in St. Petersburg. And you know, in St. Petersburg, the problem is it's a large city, and there are lots of observers. In Moscow and St. Petersburg, there are lots of observers on the polling stations. So the cost is kind of higher, and the probability of being detected is higher. So maybe that's why they also supplemented it with positive stimuli. Yeah.
So I thought that your indicator was really interesting, and I would agree with you that 40% delta is, it's a lot. But that, however, is a question, given that we know that a lot of resources go in Russia into falsification and into influencing the election results, and the teachers are just one of these resources. So don't you think that there could be something else that goes into this indicator, I mean, the teacher density, that also correlates with other kinds of pressure or administrative resources spent on during the election? I don't know, it was just an idea, so maybe there is some other regional characteristic that also goes into this density somehow. So
well,
I mean that it captures something else, not just the religious participation.
Yeah, I was trying to think that, because when I first discovered this relationship, I honestly didn't know it, although I should have believed it. I've known everything about like all these teachers, so but I didn't believe it. I thought I must control for something. My first idea was to control for the urban like the share of rural population, right? Because apparently smaller schools in rural areas mean more teachers, and rural areas also may support the regime more disproportionately, right? So it could be potentially a spurious relationship. But the interesting thing is that when you throw in the share of rural population or urban population, it's the teachers who impact the result, not the urban, not the rural population. That's what's interesting. And what I've seen in my field work, that also it's very, you know, it's very uneven. Like in one of the regions, which is very, very rural, which has the largest number of teachers per the unit of population where I went. But surprisingly, there actually the support fell pretty significantly, and that was an outlier of this from this regression result. And what was going on there is that it's an ethnic region, but it's not only ethnic region, it's the ethnicity that has clans. And those clans are competing with each other. And there are all these local politicians, but the politicians at the local level, backed up by their relatives, but their constituencies. So if one tries to put pressure on teachers and classified results, or if municipal authorities try, and usually someone, the head of the municipality, would be the competitor of that politician, right? So they would think twice, because those teachers will go and complain to the competitor. And those school principals will go and complain to the competitor. And the competitor will mobilize other resources to help those teachers. So there, it was more difficult to build this machine. While in the regions without such kind of consolidated communities and competitive local politics, that's where municipal authorities just knew that there is no one to resist their pressure. And that's where they could do whatever they wanted. So I don't know, if you have any other hypotheses about what could go there, I would be happy to hear that. And if I could test that, that would be great. Yeah.
Just out of curiosity, which region was the outlier?
The outlier, it was Republic Altai.
Okay.
Not Altaisky Krai, it's the Republic Altai. It's like this tiny, small region in the south of Siberia, but it turned out to be really interesting in this sense. There were some other ones, but that was the most radical.
Yeah. The really compelling piece is the 50% of the membership of the electoral commissions is made up of teachers. I mean, that's an astonishing fact,
right?
And telling and revealing in light of what you're after here. I'd be curious to hear about some of the other chapters, like the youth organizations and some of the other groups. What would the mechanisms be in those cases? So how would they exert their influence?
You know, the youth organizations, they don't exert their influence on elections so much. They may mobilize youth, right, to go and vote. But that is, with youth organizations, I think it's mostly monitoring the dissent and also channeling the youth energy of youth to the right direction, right? So in one of the regions, it was very interesting. I'm going to interview a vice rector on student affairs in one of the small private universities in that region. And I'm trying to talk to her to a bunch of student organizations that they have in their university, which I learned about from the website. And I'm trying to ask how those organizations came about and how, you know, like how they function. And I think that she doesn't really understand me. And I can't understand where this misunderstanding is coming from. And then at some point she says, well, no, that doesn't work like that. It's not that you have some kind of idea and you go and make this organization. It's my responsibility to build those organizations. So what turned out to happen is that she is the vice director of student affairs. She comes up with the ideas of what kind of organizations we want to have. Sometimes students may come to her with an idea, but it's going to be her decision to make this organization or not to make this organization. And then they have a fair for freshmen, like in September when they come in, so that they sign up for those organizations. So then this woman also goes regularly to the meetings in the regional department of youth, tourism, and something else, where they basically tell her what to do with those student organizations. We need like so many volunteers for this event, we need so many people for that event, we also need participation in those. So it's like a mobilization machine. But another interesting thing was that inside the university, there's organizations, they totally work as a pyramid. Because there is a student president who is elected by the whole university community, including faculty and staff. So, and she was trying to convince me that this is very democratic. We have several candidates, and they have their programs, and they present them, and we vote, we honestly vote, which may be true, you know, because all the candidates are the good ones in terms of being kind of easy to guide and to direct the energy. But what's interesting, that student president who was elected has the right to change all the heads of all student organizations. So basically, that's kind of a top-down machine rather than a bottom-up civil society, how it may look on the website. Because on the website, they totally mimic some kind of, you know, grassroots organizations. And that was the case with in this university and generally with all kinds of youth initiatives. Because it was all governed from this department for youth, tourism, and sports, I think, in the regional government.
Right about then, too, I noticed a pattern in 2010, 2011. You began to get different types of people appointed to these positions as vice rector of student affairs, and you began to get vice rectors for security. And
yeah.
These would be these new positions where they would often come in from the local police apparatus or from the interior ministry,
yeah.
And they would be working in the university
yeah.
to manage the student organization.
Yeah. So that's an example of students, like youth organizations.
And what are some of the other chapters you mentioned? So where else are you going to look?
Which regions?
Or what other types of instruments of leverage that the regime is?
So another particularly, you know, interesting, I would say, example is pensioners organizations. I totally didn't expect, because I went with this intention to totally look into, you know, social services, like of course educational system, maybe hospitals, although I didn't get a lot of hold on that, and maybe social services. But pensioners organizations was a total discovery. In some regions, this is the machine. This is the machine for mobilization. This is the machine for monitoring dissent. It was in Kemerovska Oblast where they merged this both pensioners and social services organizations to create pretty much a very effective network of knowing where the discontent takes place. They have 40 social services, it's not social service center, it's called Center for Working with the Population, Center по работе с населением, which used to be a police station, and there are 40 of them for a half a million city. So it used to be a police station, but now they have all kinds of things there. They have space for hobby clubs. They have a free lawyer. They have sports gear to give for, to rent for children for free. They attract people. Like, come here, please hang out here. And I bet all these very active babushkas, the pensioners, they are all hanging out there because they are very happy, you know, like some attention. And those are the people who know what's going on in the neighborhood, who know who is gathering where, who is going where. And they are talking among themselves, they are talking to the staff of the center, they are talking to this policeman who is sitting there. So that's a great example. And also the pensioners organizations there, it's also a hierarchy. With the head of the all pensioners organizations having an office in the regional administration, holding regular meetings with the governor, and collecting reports, like regular reports, from all the organizations down the line. So, and she was actually telling to me this week, like, yes, we'll work for the image of the governor, and we think it's right. And we don't simply go and give material support to pensioners. We have to talk to them. We have to ask what your concerns are. And, you know, which is not bad by itself, but it totally works to see where potential discontent is accumulating, and to take measures to alleviate it and to target it before it erupts into something bigger. Yeah, I can go on and on about the pensioners because they are absolutely exciting.
So, I mean, what if you put like the age structure or the percentage of pensioners in your model?
I had them, but then they were highly correlated with unemployment.
I see.
Well, actually, another thing that I can tell about the models, because I have only 79 cases, unfortunately, I don't frequently see the stability in the models that I want, and the teachers are very stable, like very stable and very confident something is going on there. But in certain configurations, I actually received a model that I believe is true, I just can't support it because I don't have enough statistical power. And that model was the combination of four factors. The teacher density, of course. Then the unemployment, because it was the higher the unemployment, the higher the regime resilience, which makes sense. Then it was this change in teacher density, how many teachers lost jobs. And then also the change in federal transfers and regional budgets. So basically, the governor has more incentive to put pressure on the state apparatus and teachers, right? Then the higher the unemployment, the more teachers lost jobs in the previous years, the more credible the threat of job loss. And the higher the number of teachers, the better the result.
So, I mean, I really love this paper. I think it's quite insightful. But the one thing that gives me concern is precisely the measure of teacher density.
Mm-hmm.
So your argument, it seems to me, it sort of assumes that the more teachers are there, the higher the proportion of teachers in the electoral commissions.
No.
Well, why not? Because if the mechanism is through falsification, like only a small percentage of teachers in any given oblast can be involved in the falsification process, right? I mean, there's thousands and thousands of teachers.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't really matter if in an oblast if there's 500 or if there's 10,000. You still can only have 20 teachers who are actually stuffing the ballot boxes, let's say. So how come, you know, the percentage or density of teachers is actually, how what's the mechanism that really links that to, you know,
well,
the availability of personnel to falsify?
Well, it's not availability of personnel to falsify, I think that's actually a minor kind of mechanism. The major mechanism is that the more teachers, the less employment is available.
Uh-huh. So it's a stronger
stick. Yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely. Imagine a small town with jobs only available in the public sector, and maybe these teachers they don't really have a chance to get another job if they are fired from this one. Right? So unlike in Moscow somewhere, where you fire a teacher, but unemployment in Moscow is pretty much zero. Particularly for someone with education. So it's really hard to put pressure on teachers in Moscow, let's say. And that's why, particularly because in Moscow there were protests. I believe that some of the values that indicated pressure, they're just wrong for Moscow. They don't want to just cook the numbers. Yeah, but I think that's the mechanism. the more teachers, the less alternative employment is available.
Gotcha. Other questions, comments?
I'm a little haunted by what I was trying to remember her name. The famous teacher at the height of Perestroika, they trotted out this very Nina Andreeva.
Yeah, Nina Andreeva.
Letter from a teacher. Arch conservative letter from a teacher. And of course, they didn't, they may have propped her up, but they didn't invent her out of whole cloth. She, in fact, represented deeply politically and culturally conservative strata of the teaching core. And I'm kind of curious if you, again, the qualitative evidence, I'm sure the whistleblowers would leap out at you, but were there other teachers kind of defending what they were doing or articulating a more conservative position, saying this is part of our duty to the state, this is
I have not seen that. But
no, it would probably defend
they may not admit it in certain terms, but they would defend their work for the ruling party in some way.
Well, in that region that I talked about pensioners, that's the attitude that people have there.
And openly so.
Very openly. Uh-huh. Because I went to that region, which is Cameras Falls, thinking that people are going to, it's very authoritarian, and I thought that I was going to be watched all the time, and people will not talk to me, people are going to be afraid. They're not afraid. They think they're doing the right thing. And they're very open. And like these people in the state, in the regional government, they're all busy with their work because they are convinced that they're doing the right thing. That their governor takes care of people, And that's why we have to support the governor, because in this way, we are actually making life for people's like better.
Or we have to falsify because the Western NGOs and Soros and the State Department are falsifying on the other side.
I think in 2012 that wasn't yet a concern. Uh-huh. It may become. It totally may become. I mean, a motivation and justification,
Or how they rationalize it.
Yeah, and particularly what's interesting, this propaganda about Western NGOs and Western funding and the US influence, it's surprisingly, it's hitting the educated people a lot. Probably more than uneducated. And given the teachers are the educated strata of the society, I think it may become really a big motivation for them. It's in addition to those mechanisms of threats to lose the job, I don't see why not to use this ideological one too in 2018.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Natalia.
Thanks.